We're in this segment of the IRWE project to record some of the history of radio and electronics. I'm speaking today to Mr. Laurie Simon. Welcome, Laurie.
Yeah, thank you.
Maybe we could commence by asking if you could give a bit of an idea how you first became interested in radio equipment.
Well, I guess I was a hobbyist, a wireless crackpot or fanatic almost, later. The usual those days. Yeah. You start with a crystal set.
Was this at school or after?
Oh, no, after I was still, I think, before I, it was still at school.
Yes.
We came from the country area, Renmark, and just leading into that, there were only two people that I can recall in Renmark those days. This is a long time ago. It'd be way over 60 years ago. And they had wireless sets. Of course, as a kid, I just couldn't comprehend how you could hear from Adelaide with these great massive antenna poles stuck up, wooden ones, yeah, of course, yeah, guide and everything. And one was the chemist, the Doc Holden, I think it was Holden, yeah. He was the pharmacist up there those days. And anyhow, it wasn't until we came to the city, and I remember my father was in the motor business, so he came down yonder and here into the Henley Beach first, of that area. And I remember running up to town, I think it was Sampson's in Rundle Street, of course, like so many others that don't exist anymore, and buying a tuning condenser, the usual rotary type. But that, I think, by memory, it was an English-made thing, but it was in bits. You had to assemble all the stator and rotor plates yourself. Oh, great job. Cost a fortune in time to do it today.
The first of the kit sets,
yeah. And I remember, perhaps I'll hold this other one. This is a thing that used to happen with the Stromberg-Carlson condenser, tuning condensers, were single gang, twin gang, triple, ten, up to four gang, if I recall, for a pre-selector.
Yes.
And they're the 175 KC intermediates, yeah, etc. But I recall that part, just making a crystal set. Of course, I thought I was Marconi himself, I guess, like all the other kids.
Yes.
And then I can't recall where I got even the first bit of information. I knew Frank O'Grady, or Mr. O'Grady, of course. He was the chief, as you well know. It's your boss, probably.
That's right.
Cliff. And when we come to the PA side of it later on, perhaps I could chase some interesting insight with a discussion with him about the condenser microphones, I call them, or capacitor. Well, then I started fiddling around, and the first radio set I made, which I sold, it must have been a Neutrodyne. It was before the Super Heterodyne. There was an American, an army bloke, I think, invented the Super Heterodyne, by memory. Mm-hmm. Forgot his name now. I think it was the Neutrodyne style of thing. I can't even remember where I got the circuits from. I wouldn't know. It's just it's the short term, mostly. I can generally remember those old things. And the power supply, by the way, Phillips people had a, made in Holland, of course, a battery eliminator come A and B, like the filament, I think of 4-volt tubes, what I call continental. I'm only guessing a bit there, whereas the American, of course, were not 4-volt ever. And it even had all these little plugs. As a matter of fact, I've got one of the little plugs, that's all I have of that era, of that particular, yeah, type of thing, with a bias supply for the tubes of each section of your circuitry.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember, and I sold it to a chemist in Somerton. I don't know what happened to that lot. And a great massive wooden cabinet. The cabinet today probably cost $500. Yeah, that sort of thing. It's incredible.
Yeah.
That was a one-off. But I think, by memory, that was the first one. Well, then, of course, one got to making your own cabinets to a degree, or Furness came into it in the Depression days. Of course, they were making pianolas in Australia, would you believe it?
Yeah.
Everything, a lot. and they went down the tube like motor cars and everything else. Nobody could afford to buy such a thing. And they went into, I don't know whether I'm crossing bridges here before I should come for me, Ian, but that helped to save them because they made thousands and thousands of radio cabinets, all veneer and that sort of thing.
Yes.
And that's the pamphlet I've been looking for, yes. By the way, with some fancy veneer finish on them. The proper veneer, not like the plastic stuff they have on them today.
Was this still in your school days when you were doing
this? No. I left school barely 40. At the end of November, my birthday, and I was the eldest of seven kids.
Yes.
So you had to go to work. But in spite of all those things those days, my sisters, the four of them, they all seemed to get jobs because they went and got them. Even on the lifts of John Martin's, that sort of thing. Well, that's getting touching back into what should be happening today with a lot of them, but it's another story, isn't it? Well, then I started, I remember doing some battery receivers before the ACs just hit the deck, as the saying is, possibly before that one I've just spoken of with the battery eliminator arrangement, I suppose you'd call it a power pack, bluish coloured, there were different models of that, I remember.
That's right, called eliminators.
Eliminators, I think
we had one bloke came into AWA once and wanted an illuminator.
Illuminator, you're going to light up a bit, Well, I don't know about lighting up. I remember that it took me, I wouldn't know how many dozens of man hours it took me to try and get this thing to receive all the local stations pretty well.
Mm. Well, how did you get into radio as a working career?
Well, this was in the, ironically enough, this was the Depression times.
Yes.
Just today in the 1930s, early, about 1930. And my father, as I said, he was in the motor business, and I started a little bit with him. He had a workshop down Somerton Way, and I won't go into that, of course, now. But we used to pull down I could pull the old cars down those days, but I'd hate to pull them down today with all the complexities. But nevertheless, he was then virtually out of work, like most people, it seems. Yes. So in the backyard, we bought a couple of motor car, as we call in those days, cases, beautiful timbers, yes. They're on the American mostly, and perhaps English, I'm not sure now. And they were very, very cheap, of course, and we put the floor down with those and extended the garage and made it into a bit of a workshop. That was at Cudmore Street, Somerton. Just along from, that street actually wasn't made on the eastern end, which ran right along the northern boundary of Sacred Heart College. But we were on the, at least there was a roadway there. and lots of beautiful blocks of land you could buy for 50 pounds if you had 50 pounds. Mm. Well, that's where I started making these. I remember now the first were the battery radios, and my father, I'd make them in a sense, and my father would sell them. And then some of them went on higher purchase. Well, that's another story. Yeah. I'll get to listen to you about that too. But keeping on this track if I can. They were just simply tuned RF receivers, I'm pretty sure, with a couple of RF stages by memory. And 2-volt filament tubes, I suppose they were. I've forgotten now what they were. Old 201A, because they were the first electric, weren't they? Yes. Yeah. They were triodes, of course. Then the pentode, as we call it, came along. Tetrode, what they called it later, a similar thing. And an uncle of mine, a brother of my father, he did sell some of those sets up around the Mallee area, around Loxton, out from around that part of the world, these battery radio sets, yes. To some of the farmers. Not a lot, of course. You'd probably just make one or two at a time those days. That's on the battery side, and up at that I drifted into the electric side. You made your own metal chassis.
How do you go for components and things like that in those days?
Well, I can remember. Well, the coils, of course, you would laugh at the crudeness of the way things were done. I still have the little hand drill, which I bought for 7 and 6, which you think about it, it was today you can buy them for three or four times the price.
Yes.
Because for the fact, of course, they're important. However, I still have that little old thing. I'd like a dollar for every revolution it had done, or has done. But I'd have that in a vice, not even a counter. Mm. You just had a concentrate. Mm. And I'd wind the coils, just sometimes on the old honeycomb coils, yes. But I really didn't use those for sold radio receivers. I don't know, I can't remember why we made the honeycomb coils. But they were a laboursome thing, you know, with a block of wood with pins around. But the by memory, I think it was silk, enamel-covered silk-covered wire, copper. And on tubular, you'd buy it in about a metre or a yard those days, of course, or foot or whatever. About, what, talking old measurements, about 1.5 inches in diameter.
Yes.
Bakelite, I think you call it, wouldn't
it? Bakelite, yeah. Tubing.
And you just cut it all by hand.
Yes.
I didn't have any machine, mechanical machinery whatsoever. Is this, am I going
on the track? Right. How many of these a week would you have made, these radios?
Well, that'd be, I can't recall the exact number.
Like, would it be one or two?
Oh, you'd probably make a couple, I'd a wild guess at this stage. And of course, later on, I'd make them on batches of half a dozen or so. And we'd buy, that's a little later, I mentioned about the chassis work. The metal chassis, and how I used to spray them, finally, big deal, spraying them, mind you. And that was a hand-pumped spray, by the way. No machines to pump the air. Well, as I said, I'd make these coils. You'd even make the little brackets out of a bit of aluminium, because it'd be cheaper than buying them. You'd make the little washers to go, where the terms would go through the chassis.
Yes.
Because I guess they were cheaper. I can't recall. You'd make them out of fibre.
They probably weren't even available to buy, were they?
Oh, I don't know whether they would be available. No. I suppose the big manufacturers, AWA, probably had those, but they weren't, not like today, of course. You couldn't go and buy these little bits. The terminals, they were the old-fashioned ones, you know. And, of course, the first radios, I think we touched them the other day, the first radios, of course, you'd have the bus bar. On Bakelite, as you know, the Bakelite, but I didn't do too much of that. It must have been about the time we started to get into the chassis type of thing, still bus bar to a degree.
So you weren't even soldering joins then?
Was all, no.
Was all screw terminals?
The pointed nose pliers, you know?
Yes.
But looping the... they were around not many years ago, but that they went out in the rubbish, I suppose, too, unfortunately. And as you know, and I was referring to... Electronics Australia.
Yes.
And I was talking to you last time. And they have been putting in some of these old heirlooms, I'll call them, an EMCO. And they're rather a circular looking transformer. I suppose they were Stalloy laminated things. And I never saw the inside, as a wonder matter of fact. But you just have the primary and secondary, you know, little fancy little screwed.
So you used to buy the power transformers and the audio transformers, is that what they were?
Those, yes. At the beginning.
And you wound those.
Oh, for the very, very first radios, they were transformer, a couple, of course.
Yes.
And the audio. And they were electrodynamic. Oh, no, well, that'd be later, of course. Later, the first ones, of course, were what? The old. Electromagnetic devices, weren't they? Like the old Philips and some of those speakers. Before the dynamic moving coil speakers came on. That was, of course, following the old, basically headphone-style Amplian.
Yes.
With an adjustable diaphragm, so you could, if you put the level up a bit too much, you had to pull the diaphragm back a little wee bit, otherwise they obviously get the clatter with the expensive horn. But I never sold any of those. They were just these other cone type of speakers. Not so efficient, probably, but but nevertheless a little bit of medium from the lower end down a little bit more than the old horn type, and they were just a high impedance thing, I think, which started off the plate and out of the output tubes, if I recall. I don't know what happened about the demagnetisation of the, or otherwise of the. Magnetising of the coil.
Who did you buy your loudspeakers from? Mm-hmm. Like Dar Amplian loudspeakers?
Yeah, they probably would have come from Newton McLaren.
Yes.
I might add too, I've forgotten to mention this just quickly, I worked for one boss for 1 year when I was about probably 14 and a half to 15 and a half roughly.
Yes.
And I used to ride a push bike from Somerton up the middle of Anzac Highway, where now the plantation is, and the wind was always blowing to or fro.
The opposite direction to which you were going.
Unless you got behind an open-top double-decker bus, and that the eddy currents would suck you along, irrespective of the carbon monoxide you put down. Now, you asked me a question.
Well, your main work eventually became involved with amplifiers. How did you get started in the public address business?
There's a bit more perhaps on the radio. I'm not sure exactly when I got into the... But it fascinated me, this amplification. I can't recall precisely what motivated me to do it or where I got the idea from, because to my knowledge, nobody else in South Australia, I was the first one to ever have anything. They stood up in the Palais and all these big... anywhere, with a piece of cardboard, megaphone. But as far as the radio goes, well, just finishing that off, if that's what you'd like to hear. Just a couple of interesting things. As crude as they were, I used aluminium chassis, by them the sheet, of course. I used to get them cut, do them myself first, then later you'd get them cut up, perhaps you'd knock up, by memory, say a dozen or 15 or something chassis for... say two valve and red fire. There was only a Reinhardt thing, of course. I tried direct coupling and put them out once another. Resistors, they were hopeless things, and they were not the carbon little type of thing we've got today. They were a piece of glass with some carbon inside and fuse wire, looked like roped around each end and then solder in capped ends.
Yes, I can remember those.
They were nightmare things. They never seemed to be stable. So that was the end of the direct coupling. But the little two-valve and rectifier, you'd make them in mantle models, as we call them, all wooden cabinets, of course, furnished, make them. And the console, cheap one, £19, 19 and 16 or something. And that's the pamphlet I've been looking for. And there was a three-valve, whether the difference, basically, of course, it had an RF stage. It had a two-gang condenser and an extra coil, of course. Then we had, came into the, of course, the super heterodynes came along about that period.
Just before we got onto the super heterodynes, with these old one or two and three valve ones, did you install them for the people, or were they able to install them themselves? Or
I think we'd always, you take and carry. We had an old buckboard for utility, buckboard we used to call it. And later on, of course, what you now call a panel van. But... invariably you'd install them because people didn't know anything about wireless sets.
But you'd have to put up an aerial, wouldn't you, outside aerial?
Not always. No, very seldom. I think you got enough, although the transmitters those days are very low in power, and a bit of static didn't worry most people. However, you just simply got enough going with these little two-valve Reinhardt things, if you knew how to fiddle with the old reaction side of it before she ran into the birdies, as the saying is. It's amazing what you could get out of those things. And the first ones were electro. That's following on what we said before about those Phillips cone speakers. Yes. They were all electrodynamic before then permanent magnets became available, of course. And I think they had about the... from memory, I think getting ahead a little bit, with the risk of dropping out a couple of bits, all the transformers those days, I think, got about 385 volts either side.
Yeah, so we're into the AC type.
You're getting into the AC type.
With the field coils of the loudspeakers working as the
filter, filters. The choke, yes. And a couple of liquid, what do you call them, electrolyte, electrolyte condensers sort of thing. I found that a freak thing were those too, because you know what it is when you're on the bench and you want to service something, you reckon you know everything one does, and you take all sorts of shortcuts supposedly to save time, odd times blowing a filament and a some filaments in the battery radio set because yeah, the screwdriver slipped or something. But on this point, the electrolytic condensers, you'd kill them right off. I'm not sure how that used to, by memory now, how that used to happen. If you shorted them out, there should be some sort of back EMF possibly from the filter. Something like that, and that was the end of the condenser. You had to take it out and lose the capacity entirely.
Did they short circuit or just...
No, they just
neutralised the thing.
Yeah, the film or whatever was in the electrolyte, they were aluminium alloy.
And it was a gas, the dielectric, yes.
Yeah, as you know, some of them blew up at odd times and leaked and whatever. But... do you want to talk about the chassis, by the way, before I get on
the power? Well, perhaps quickly.
Well, quickly the chassis, because time's moving on. The chassis, all I had was a vise, a hammer, some blocks of wood, not even a bending machine, and you simply bend them in that. You got that one, got that proficient at doing it, you got to whack them through, and I could make a radio set in, you know, no time. It seems incredible now to me even. One the called, we're doing one's own power transformer, that came later. I used to buy them from Henderson's. We'd get a great wooden crate full of these transformers, and they'd weigh a lot. They're Sydney crowd. I don't know whether they're not in business today, as far as I know.
I can remember Henderson transformers. I don't know if they're still around there.
Yeah, and different sizes, of course, for the different, probably two sizes, one for the larger sets. And,
how do you go on for the valve socket?
Oh, well, now I was just going to mention that. The valve socket was a fantastic invention. A leather punch.
Yes.
What, about those days, inch and a quarter, inch and an eighth diameter, over which you'd put your coils. They're a bit big for the electrolytic condensers. Yes. And the valve socket, of course. Amphenol was one better type, as you know, that clipped in. And there was the goat shields that came on the tubes.
Yes.
And it saved a bit of time. And they had the clip base. Although I used to get all my Austral metal. They're still in business, aren't they?
Yes,
Austral sheet metal, or what are they calling themselves? And I used to order them by the gross valve shields. It meant it had a ring base.
Yes.
Which you'd screw in with your sockets. By the way, every hole was drilled by hand. Mm-hmm. Didn't have a power drill, of course. And the valve can, which is beautifully made, spun, and clear aluminium, nicely made, and that simply just go over the tube.
Yes.
And the coil's the same principle. Just get the coil base, let it go on with a couple of little eighth-inch screws, and... the little bracket to hold the coil former itself upright, and they would just simply just tight fit. You wouldn't need to do much about it. But I do. I made one boo-boo once, just quickly. I don't know why I did this, because it didn't save much time, but I found out after a period of time, because of what you'd call a corroded dry joint or two, and the coils would... you'd buy these little tiny tinned lugs, solder lugs.
Yes.
Teardrop shaped things. And I'd use little rivet hand, little tiny eyelets. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I didn't, which I woke up to after a while, of course. You'd take the enamel, of course, off the... strip the enamel off the wire of the coil itself. And I'd put it around, instead of bringing it around and then soldering it on the lug where you take your leads away, I used just the clenching, crimping idea, if you like.
Yes.
And of course, the former probably moved in time, and the copper would oxidise possibly in time, and they gave me a few headaches later on.
Yeah.
But of course, I woke up once, I got the first one. Of course, I probably went back and fixed the others. I can't recall right now the details. But now,
what brand did you sell your radios that you made?
Oh, Undernamus.
Undernamus.
Oh, that was Namus. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
I don't know where I got that idea. I probably got the idea from Cornell and Lenrock.
Oh, yes.
And in due course, just more latter years, of course, to Dion Skinner, he turned his back to front and got Rennox.
Right.
In fact, just quickly, the fellow that bought my business, he bought that business. He still has that business. But the name of the show has been sold again. That's Neil Muller's group. Limbert's.
Mm-hmm.
One of the Limbert boys is the managing director of the show nowadays. But at least it's in the family of the electronic area sort of thing.
Well, perhaps we could get onto the PA days.
I could yak on for a long time about the valve, but you can get a lot of this. You've already had some, probably get plenty more on the radio side, and you can spend weeks of course on it. And a lot of little things that would have happened, I suppose, I could have brought up. We used to buy, perhaps I could just quickly, before we leave it, loudspeakers. When the dynamic speakers came out, Jensen were made in Australia. The actual pots, heavy metal of course, of the housing, electromagnetic housing, I believe the housings of the conical shaped housing of the speaker themselves, I think they're all pressed down at the Holden plant here, but they're all assembled and made in Sydney, I think it was Sydney. And they were pretty good. They were electrodynamic, as I said before. You did use them. I think they were, I've forgotten the impedance, the ohmage, I should say, or the resistance of the total of the field coil. But anyhow, at about 100 volt drop, I could recall.
Usually 2,500.
That time, I was going to say, around about that, because it gave you about 250 volts to use on your circuitry. And then there was another one too. It came out in a chromy plated type. And also there's the Magnavox. You remember the Magnavox?
Magnavox.
It was about a 7-inch rather than 8-inch cone. And I always remember Reg George was using the Jensen, I think, and I was using this Magnavox at the time. And I think the Jensen might have had the edge, I don't know, as far as overall performance is concerned. But the beauty of those was you could take one bolt out of the pole piece of the speaker, you could just take the cone out.
You could also adjust the centering so
that's
it didn't
right.
rub.
Yes, easier yes. To, if you had to change, which is a very rare thing, of course, these days.
But even if they went off centre a little bit, didn't they?
But very quickly, too. I know this was a friend of my father's, and he was dreadfully hostile about this. His set had to be serviced. So the set that my father would perhaps, in the early days before he had a staff, he would probably go and get the sets out, and I'd fix them, of course, and he'd take them back. But the speaker, although it was put in with an Amphenol fitting, I think, an Amphenol plug, 4-pin plug.
That's right.
Like the old UX with the 80 socket, 4-pin socket. And he got a speaker back. I've forgotten the name of this darn speaker we were using at one stage, 8-inch. Electrodynamic.
Yeah, Amplion were in the market then too.
Yeah, they weren't Amplion. I can't think. Anyhow, it's gone now. I can't remember what it was. I haven't thought about it for a long time. And this one was not chrome plated when he got it back. They must have got switched accidentally, inadvertently somewhere. Oh, he thought we were putting one over him. And I don't know whether he ever got it. I can't recall now. They were one of the funny little things. It wasn't funny at the time. He was very hostile about it.
And did your father actually, was he the one who started Nomus, or out of it before you started?
No, he knew nothing about it.
He was just selling the radios that you made.
He did the selling.
Right.
And I might add that very quickly too, my first attempt on selling was I had a motorbike and sidecar. This is must have been number one, the beginning of the story at this stage now. And I went to Jay and Taylor's and bought a second-hand sidecar. And I took off. This has nothing to do with the business, but I have to tell you, because it was really a stupid thing. I learnt the quick, hard way how to ride a bike, a motorcycle, with a sidecar. And I'm very lucky it wasn't a car coming the opposite direction. Because I took off Smarty Simon, took off down Anzac Highway, which was a single road, as I said earlier, down the middle of the road, and dirt tracks either side, if you like. And I went out to pass a motor car. Smarty, you see. Like the kids do today, I guess. I couldn't get back. because of this imbalanced feeling. Yeah. And I shot out over to the right-hand side. Well, that was the lesson. I learned quick. And I put a little carrier on the back of that. And these were battery radios then. For some reason, I don't know why I didn't make them, but they were made by somebody else, a fellow in Rundle Street somewhere, I could recall. Before the Super Heterodyne, they were just RF stage battery-operated radios. And my father had connections in the country because he came from a country family in the farming areas. Right around the peninsula we'd go on this motorbike and side go down the summer tracks. You could do anything with the darn thing. And I'd have this radio on the back. He'd be trying to sell insurance and I'd be trying to flog, as the saying is, a radio set to a farmer. Very seldom would you sell one. That's history. That's a long time. Yeah. Now, getting on the PA.
Yes, PA.
That's always been, of course, the PA's been the radios that went down the sink as far as I was concerned. I sold thousands, I suppose, of other brands and subsequently in the middle of the whole show, but when I was on the retail side. Mm. But that's not the story. But I remember the first PA. I can tell you very quickly the very, very first public address systems ever to be used in South Australia, to my knowledge, and I'm pretty sure it's authentic. And you wouldn't believe it, ironically enough, that the South Australian Hotel, the lovely old hotel that doesn't exist anymore, where you could not get in there unless you had a tie, at least, and a coat and so forth. That was the first hotel in South Australia to have a loud-speaking paging system, would you believe it? And background music later.
Gee.
And, of course, the paging system comprised a wooden case, which I think I made myself, with an aluminium panel sprayed up afterwards by this hand-pumped, like a motor car tyre pump in a little tank. You just pump that up and you do a bit of spray, then you pump again as it goes on. And that's what you do with the chassis later. Right. Over the nice aluminium at times. But getting back to the old PA, well then, they had a couple of complaints, quickly enough I might say, that one fellow they mentioned to me had come up and he was very annoyed that his name had been called over the intercom, as he called it, or the PA paging. He said, "I'm not here." Which is very naughty in those days, at least. And that was the first part. Now, that was, I remember all the bars and the dining room and all these other areas, they all rapidly switched with the old L&R keys, which I'd buy from PMG West Terrace, like a lot of things, the old condenser. That's what I said about the old condenser microphone units. And then the dance hall, nobody had ever used an amplifier in the dance halls, and I always remember the very first one, the first big one, of course, the old Palais Royal, where Huey Carmichael, and there was Huey Carmichael, Aubrey Hall down at the King's, and then Bert Angus ran the Embassy, that was in Grenfell Street, and then later on the big massive shed, as the saying is, the Palladium in Perry Street, top end of, or eastern end of Perry Street. Of course, I equipped all those hotels, and there's nobody else had anything. I didn't know what it was about. I can remember distinctly the first, very first one was a little hall. I don't even know if it's there now. It's right next door to St. Francis Xavier's Cathedral in Wakefield Street, and of course they had a weekly dance there. Strictly no.
It was called Levitt Hall, I think.
Yes, it may have been. I think they used to call it the Rinker Dance Club. Mm. And they were packed out in there.
And that was the first.
That was the very first
PA system.
PA entertainment, if you like, mini entertainment public address system used in Adelaide. And Frank Kennedy, is the Bing Crosby days, of course, and he was good. Poor old Frank, he got him on later. But
And was the hotel, the South Australian Hotel, was that the first installation that you did in a, like in a paging system?
That was the first, by memory, that was the first paging system, yes. Yeah. It was all hand, just one of, you know.
And you made the amplifiers for that?
Oh, yes. I've forgotten what we had in there. A couple of, let me see now, would there be the 42s, the 42 tubes? It'd be, I think it'd have about push-pull output, of course. And I can't recall what sort of coupling transformer I had. I might have been, I made myself, like to the sound speaker line.
Yes.
Of course, way before the voltage, the constant voltage line system. But that was in a wooden thing. It suited that because it looked like a little bit of furniture on the desk. The telephonist had it there. But I must quickly tell you, too, the first microphones, of course, there were the first mics I ever had, and all the hams had them those days, the old Reese carbon mic. By the way, how do you spell that word, Reese?
R-E-I-S-S, I think.
Well, I've spelled it that way in different ways, and I was talking to Jack about it, and that's about how I work at it. Reese is what I've always called it.
Yeah.
Well, I made up one about 2 years ago, or just after I retired, about up to 3 years ago, because the original ones, like a lot of the old heirlooms, they have just disappeared. I loaned one, by the way, to a then PMG radio inspector who lived at Blackfriars. I can't even recall his name now. I never got it back. But they were made, basically, apart from the gold-plated brass electrodes and mica diaphragm, and the carbon granules. Instead of it, this was before the marble. I don't know whether the other people had, the other fellas had marble then or not, I can't recall. But I have some pictures there, and I have a photograph of the one I'm, it's a sort of a replica as near as I could in every possible way to the one that I used to use 55 to 60 years ago.
So you made your own microphones up?
Oh, yes, right back then. Mm. Oh, yes.
And you could buy the carbon granules and things
like that? Yes, the carbon granules, just buy them by the... Oh, I've forgotten how you'd buy them. Were they weight or what? I can't recall. But I had quite a lot of those.
What sort of places would be around that would handle things like that you could buy all of these?
Well, you know, ironically enough, Micah, when I went to make this recent one up, which I sent over to the Telecom Museum, by the way, because they didn't have one like this. Nor it's made out of a piece of 4x4x6 timber instead of the marble, so it's much bulkier and so forth. And I've got a picture there where the first one was used at the Adelaide Oval, or one of the earlier ones, and the centenary of this state, the 100th year, that's 50 years back from last year, and I had several of them. I can see it right now, like it's 5 minutes ago, on the Lanilga Oval, where they had a sort of a reenactment of the landing, which they did, as you know, more so and more comprehensively. And this is recent, what, last year?
82 years
now, or three. See, that's time gone again. Flex. No shielded cables. There was no shielded cable available with a sheath anyhow those days. Just the braid, the shield itself. And you had to know the tricks of the trade, of course, which I learnt there after a few years. And this is where most people used to get in trouble with PA. They couldn't understand this spurious supersonic oscillation between ins and outs and input and output, and that sort of thing. Wet conditions and all sorts of... You could write books about that aspect of PA alone.
What sort of loudspeakers did you use for the outside PA? You're talking about...
Well, the first ones, the one at the rink, the inside one, I'm not answering your question, but nevertheless, that was just, by memory, a 12-inch... That must have been in the permanent magnet, the first permanent magnet speakers. Of course, they were very inefficient then. They're not that wonderful now. No speaker is, but as you know, but they're very inefficient. But I can't remember the tubes, by the way. They were AC. And they were just in boxes, you know, about, 15 inches square, 8 inches deep or so, just open back things, full of resonance, I suppose. And But then the Palais, if I could mention that.
Yes.
Well, that was probably the most striking thing of the whole lot, because you could imagine this big old Palais where there's now a car park, I think it's a spot. In fact, I think they call it the Palais Park. Carmichael's and the Bogue Smith band, the big band, it was the big band, the Glenn Miller's type, and they're coming back today. And Bogue Smith, of course, Harry with his tails, always had the tails on, dolled up, same as the Palladium. He was the band, he was the fellow around there as well. And I suppose I used a couple of the old 250, the 50 tubes, just triodes. Well, of course, everybody thought I was mad, because on paper you can only get about 4 watts out of each one. Well, basically in class A you'd get supposedly something like 9 watts. But because I did use tetras. I'm getting away from your comment, but I'll stick on to the speakers perhaps first, Ian,
right. With
this jumbled discussion of mine. They were electrodynamic speakers, as we used in the first Anzac Day march. Oh my goodness. You had to energise all the field coils. Different lines, separate lines, thumping great power supplies on the racetracks and everywhere else. I used to wind all those big transformers out of the way. 3 5Z3s in parallel to get the current capacity. But the Palais, we used to use them at some of the sporting events. I can remember out at Norwood Oval before they had the athlete people had their facilities they've got today, and then they went to the parklands, the South Parklands. But we had these so-called very big, well, about a metre square at the mouth, so-called three-ply ribbed with extra strength. I think we made myself. You make everything yourself. Couldn't afford to buy it. And an old Jensen 8-inch electrodynamic speaker, the first ones.
So they were like a loudspeaker driving an exponential.
That's it. A so-called exponential. Yeah. Very crude, nothing like the proper like exponential in fact.
No, but
generally in theory it helped to project the sound a bit, because the speakers are terribly inefficient. And so I had two of those. I put them in the Palais, or temporarily. You'd do anything to try and earn a shilling, as the saying was.
Yes.
And I can remember the first night, the crowd, and he had about 900 or 1,000 people there to get on a Friday and Saturday night, mostly old-style dancing. And on came the vocalist, and everybody seemed to be stunned, because they'd never heard it before, because previously they just stood up there, the vocalist, with a piece of, as I said before, a piece of cardboard. It's a conical shaped cardboard. And it became a sort of a bit of a concert for a while. They couldn't, what's this all about? I can't comprehend quite what they were thinking, of course, but I can imagine perhaps. And well, that just led to that. And mind you, that the first one was the Reese mic, and of course they're pretty, a lot of distortion.
Yes.
Well, then came the condenser microphone. You want me to go on that point?
Yes, because the Reese microphones, as I recall, had a lot of noise, didn't they? Hiss.
Oh,
noise.
Yes, if you turned up the gas. They had a lot of output.
Is someone out there trying to get in? Perhaps, Laurie, you might like to tell us about some of the big PA jobs. Take, for example, Anzac Day. How did you get involved in those, and what was the size of the job?
Well, they were massive in the beginning, unfortunately, in a sense, because not having done a thing of that depth before, with very crude speakers and equipment.
What sort of speakers would you have used?
Well, a mixture of all sorts, but they're all 12-inch. Some of them are even electrodynamics. Mm. We had to run field line support to energise. And the first marches, when they used to start, are way down because of the numbers of people in the march those days and the length of it. They were absolute nerve-wracking things as far as I was concerned, because everything was done so crudely, and we had 11 operating points. Well, Fedpo, PNG, those days, of course, with your fingers crossed, etc. And you had to get into offices upstairs. I can see it right now in, say, King William Street on the holiday. So you had to make all these arrangements to get into these buildings, and you had to have men to operate them, etc. And we had some almost disasters. You know, it's incredible how it's like flying a plane and it crash lands, but just somehow you get out of it in time.
So these 11 points were each amplifier feeding so many speakers.
That's right. And of course, obviously, I can't record exactly how many speakers. It depends on each amplifier, of course. Mm. I mean, I was even trying to use some 6L6s, remember? Because I hated those things, tetrodes. Can I just mention about the tetrodes and triads?
Yes.
Because I was always a triad fellow. And you can bring me back onto the rails if you don't mind, Ian. For the simple reason, and this is the thing that to me, as one humble bloke who's not a high tech, of course, never was, but I was what you'd call a practitioner. I believed in the thing has to work, never mind about all the theory, that is putting it crudely. So, really, the what was the point? I've lost my point.
Well, about the size of the amplifiers
and
different points down the...
Yeah, but I was...
This march, I gather, went from what, South Terrace down to...
Well, just about. They started away down yonder past Wakefield Street, and they'd also go up Wakefield Street and Goodger, is it across, for assembly. So they had a separate system for the assembly as well. In fact, I think they still do, I think. They used to, last I had to do with it. I was going to make an interesting point, but it's slipping my mind now. But they were really nightmare things, and it always, it seemed, to be raining on the 25th of April each year. However, I do recall, if I can make a quick one, and Mr. of the PMG department, see, there was no body professionally that could go to those days, and Frank O'Grady, the chief, well, he was the man in charge, if you know what I mean, to see that I and everybody else did everything right. They must have, I guess it was one of those jobs he was asked to do.
And was your PA realised, like in conjunction with the broadcasts, the same, was it a
program.
Commentary?
No. Never, that's never been the case.
Was it only relaying band?
It's purely the band and announcements, and also they read the ode and that sort of thing at the over the PA, and also at the beginning, of course, they'd have the waiting for the chime, whatever it was it 10 o'clock or 10:30 or whatever. I think they've altered a bit the starting time, but those days it's probably more early than due to the number of people marching. Well, as I said, we had all these amplifiers with various people. We split them up so you could approximately get the same amount of energy to each speaker, crudely speaking, and depending on the type of speaker. So you had to just use your common sense to do the best you could. You go right up north to Grenfell Street, I think it was. Yes, Grenfell Street, then up to... was it Rundle Street? Rundle Street. Then up Charles Street. And the thing was to, in the North Terrace, to go past the War Memorial, logically enough. And of course, they've had to give that away due to the length of the older men not being able to march. So that gradually got cut down. And of course, in addition to that, they don't have the numbers.
That's the War Memorial on Kintore Avenue corner.
Yeah, on the corner. Yes. That's right. And of course, that's logical that they want to go past that. So they had to bypass that. There was no other way to get over it. Well, then down at the Pennington Gardens, Cross of Sacrifice, as we used to call it, we'd have a great massive wooden tower. We used to put these things together with bolts and nuts.
Yes.
Put them on the top of the vehicle, though. Wooden tops. And those days, then, we'd have some pretty good speakers there. And subsequently, I got onto the Jensen M20. He's still electrodynamics. If we've got a bit of time, I'll tell you about those. Quite interesting, perhaps. But I always remember on one occasion, the next, and then of course the guardhouse at the Government House gates, that was always, in fact in the recent years, we did the whole, we only used 2 points, by the way, and that was the town hall balcony feeding either way,
yes,
even the assembly from yeah. there, and either way, bigger amplifiers of course,
yes,
and better speakers, and the guardhouse, that'd come over up to some of Kingwin Street and then go right down to the bridge.
Mm.
And then, because you have a separate system for the service down at the Pennington Gardens. I always remember on one occasion, raining like mad, and I got down there and I had an amplifier down there which probably wasn't good thinking on my part. It is one of what we used to call, subsequently, Big Bertha. The latter ones were 805 tubes with about 1200 volts on the anodes, zero bias, which is a fantastic thing for portable PA. And you could really punch it out yes. with those. And as I said before, I know what I was talking about, the triad, if you want to yes. get back to that in a minute. And when I got down there, I was running around like a lunatic, Skinny Simon. I got down there, and some character had moved the canvas top off it, Mr. Nobody, we don't know who to this day, and there's a wooden cabinet with wooden sides with clips, and they'd been taken off full of water. I daren't turn it on. You would have heard the noise up at the town hall. So, but that's the way we used to do it crudely, and it's a devastating thing. I could tell you other things about it, but they wouldn't be of great interest to other
what about
people.
Places like, say, the race course?
Well, the race course, what was that other point I just mentioned to you?
Oh, about the triodes. Did you want to
yes,
get back to
the triodes?
Yes,
perhaps a quick point there yeah. before you get there. Because I was always dedicated, so to speak, to triodes. And, of course, the more tech fellows around in the IRE and everywhere else, they couldn't understand why I just used these triodes. You get a couple of
66s
yes. became 807s, didn't they, yes. with an end on the top. Yeah. Then there was an 809, which yes. was another yes. story. They were pretty good. They were triodes, though. But anyway, getting back to this, I built some, wound all the transformers up myself, driving, and there's a couple of tricks I learnt, of course, automatically by hard yak, I suppose. The triodes in practice, with the varying impedance, of course, of loudspeakers, that's where they used to get trapped.
Yes.
The Philips and all the big companies, of course, are using tetrodes. Now, in the lab, of course, they are fantastic. Now, you cook your breakfast on, of course, they got that hot. But they reminded me of using transistors. Once you get to the saturation, they just fold up. And tetrodes to me were the same. I tried all sorts of negative feedback, as you call it those days, and so forth. And I recall taking one to the Snowtown Trotting. We used to do the snow, all those things, those shows, every show in South Australia, and dog, cat race, whatever. And I took this thing up with 4 6L6s and push-pull parallel. I also found that they caused oscillatory problems until I woke up, found out for myself, I couldn't find any information under the scenes. You had to put stoppers in the grid circuit, although it was a matter of keeping the impedance down in the grid
yes.
circuit, because they're all transformer coupled with power drivers, not yeah. just of capacity couple stuff. That would never do the job. You had to hard drive that stuff. And I could tell you about the later ones, how I used to even buy transformers and alter the manufacturer's windings, step down rather than step up.
Yes.
But if I answer that question?
Oh, I think, yeah, as far as the triads
are concerned. But I think the difference is there is that on paper the triads were hopeless, but in practice you could put them into distortion, but the human ear would not pick up the distortion as it would with the tetrodes yeah. or triads.
Right. Can we get back onto perhaps the race course or
yep.
one of those big
right.
jobs? You know, how you, what sort of speakers you use and how you.
Well, the first race course speakers that I used, that came not right at the beginning, of course. but it was the Jensen M. I mentioned it very quickly earlier. Now, the Jensen M, to emphasise how I came to use them, I got hold. I had a fellow with a fellow in a sideshow had one. He travelled all over Australia, and he had a fellow with him, Ben somebody. I didn't know the man then, and it seemed to be a tremendously terrific loudspeaker, just a cone with about a 2-inch voice coil. Yeah, real.
They had a little power supply on the side, didn't they?
They were earlier. No, they had, didn't. They were 2,500 ohms. The with a great massive field coil, yeah. Weighed about a couple of kilograms, huge things with a big cast iron pot and aluminium housing.
Yeah.
Now, I only ever bought one of those, but I had a lot more. Because I made them. I'll tell you about that in a minute. The first one I heard was this fella, and I thought, well, now I've got to get it. And it was the International Radio Corporation or Company in Sydney with the agents for these things,
yes.
Jensen.
Yes.
They're imported. They also had a 12-inch thing that came out later, much cheaper, but they were very efficient with a curved cone. Yes. But keeping with the M20, this was the answer at the time, of course, as against the speakers we had then, because the others were so terribly inefficient. And I can see myself now, and this is a long time ago, it'll be 40 years ago for today, out of Kernlight Gardens. It's an equestrian horses and action show on an oval. And we had a tower, this wooden tower again, stuck in the middle of the oval, horses and everybody around. Yeah, they wanted to hear all around, of course. And we had these baffled... had the big horn things that I spoke of earlier with the 8-inch Jensen speakers.
Yes.
Well, they heard, I suppose. So I got this thing that I just bought and experimented with it. And I thought, oh, well, we'll give it a try. I bought it. Cost a fortune those days. And I must have made up a power supply for it, energizer. And we put this on with just a flat board. Well, you couldn't hear the others. The incredible uplift in efficiency was mind-boggling, really, to me, those days. So hence, what I did then, you literally couldn't afford to buy another stack of them. I went to Mason and Cox, got the pots made, and got them all turned up, the poles, great big 2-inch poles, and there was a big plate, which is the ring plate for the... surrounding with a bright right cap, got the castings done due to shrinking, so a fraction smaller, and I made, 15 or 20 of them.
And what about the cones? How did you...
I had to buy the cones. Mm-hmm. Supposed to be replacement cones. Well, they were. That's the only part I couldn't do. And, of course, the transformer, well, I'd wind that, of course,
yes.
Make a transformer, which would handle, 20 or 30 watts or something.
Yes.
But they, by the way, they had two layers of aluminium wire to get the weight down way back those days. But I had a little bit of trouble with the termination on those. Now, we're at the race courses. Well, they were the first speakers to be used on the race courses. And I can see it, Morfordville, that was the first track, and we'll just concentrate on that for a minute. From the back of the stand, we used to work, they wouldn't have the loudspeakers just out front. We were out on the flat. That's how far we had to throw it, with flat baffles first. And, you know, you didn't have the power those days. I've forgotten exactly what amplifiers I started with on that time, but I can come along directly and tell you what we finished up with. And we had these wires, hard-drawn copper, telephone line fashion, from the back of the stand out over the whole tracks, the running track, the tan track and the training track, out on this stand, and they were about 15 feet high, because you went pretty high.
Yes.
And they had bigger crowds those days than what they get today, too, to make it worse. Of course, you didn't have all the complexities they've got today, physical-wise. Well, then, it used to really... I used to think, what would happen if one of those wires dropped down and cut all the heads off these poor jockeys, you know? So we then improved on that, and we put seven-strand, seven-note, whatever this cable was, and ultimately, of course, we went into underground. Yes. Well, then Roller brought out a 12, or was it a 12O?
And a 12OX.
OX? Mm. Well, that came later.
The extra cone. 12O first.
Yeah, well, the 12O, the first 12Os, though, were the magnetic field was not good enough. They were very inefficient. Oh, they wouldn't live with these M20s.
12U.
The 12U, was that the 12U or was that a smaller one again? Same size, but a smaller magnet. I might be wrong with this O. Anyhow, they were not efficient enough. But then they came up, I think it was the 12U then they came along with later. And that had a better magnetic field. And the efficiency was getting near these. And of course, that was a godsend, so to speak, because it got rid of all the field problems. Yeah. Because there's something great. Transform with the three, as I said, 5Z3s,
yes.
And I used to use a couple of auto lamps, not as fuses, well, fuses too, if you like, and I could tell by the brilliance of those, and very low, of course, in brilliance naturally, that's why I used two of them. I forgot what amperage they were drawing, but anyhow, current, I should say. But they were in series, of course, with the supply, DC supply. Well, that's the first part. Now, the microphone, the first ones, I can see myself right now, would you believe it, the crude, well, it makes you a bit mind-boggling, at Cheltenham Racecourse. We then used to carry one of these great massive amplifiers up these back stairs, you know, about 45 degrees angle. They were terribly heavy, the amplifiers. Mm. Carry those, struggle up to the top, right on the top deck. They wouldn't allow us to go down on the underneath the top deck. And the top deck was open to the weather, the elements. You can imagine on a nice windy, rainy day. And the Reese Carbon microphone with old Ike Treloar, who was about the first commentator on the tracks, that would be sitting on the balustrade, just sitting there. And he'd be there with his glasses. I often thought, well, it's the one we didn't lose the microphone over the top. But, you know, it's incredible. It seemed to work those days, and yet if you didn't do it today, you'd be thrown out in 5 minutes.
Yeah, so it just speakers shows out on the flat as well as along the...
And they were out on the flat.
Yes.
They were all out on the flat.
Yeah.
And then, of course, subsequently, at a time, everything changed and we used horns. You didn't get the same roundness, if you like, of quality, or the public like this roundness, as the saying is, which of course is pretty terrible when you've got acoustical problems. Besides, you've got to have a lot of power to get any bass into. You don't want bass. Most often we cut. They were the only tone control, by the way, we ever had. The only tone controls I ever had in the amplifiers was always bass cut.
Yes.
Never mind about the tops. The thing was to get sufficient. That's why that salt shaker microphone was... it had a lot of crispness in the top register, particularly the speech spectrum.
With the spectrum. Horns, you're still talking about the ones that were driven with a cone-type loudspeaker?
Oh, no. With the exponential.
With a screw-on
Yes. I was always against them because of the quality. And, of course, the earlier ones were pretty hard to listen to say the least. But at least, I guess, the racing public and the public in general, perhaps
right,
I was too fussy.
Though
all they have to know is where that horse is. That's all they worried about, really, I guess, when you look at it from the public's point of view. So I was worrying unnecessarily, perhaps, about the quality instead of the quantity, if you like, to get it into those eardrums.
Yes, they were all right for speech, though, weren't they, those
things? Yes. Well, of course, they improved them a lot in the more modern ones. Of course, they're not bad at all.
No.
In fact, they're not too bad on music for outside PA, you know, just ordinary stuff, not I mean entertainment.
What would be the biggest PA job you ever did?
Well, the Anzac Day, the earlier Anzac Day marches would have been the biggest. Of course, we overcome a lot of problems in due course there too, and got much more effectively to do it. We learned a lot of pitfalls, and I could tell you stories further about that, but anyway, keeping back to the biggest jobs, that was probably one of the biggest jobs, because you see and of course with public address, the function start dong, that's it. You don't get any change, as the saying is, or sorry, just hold up for 5 minutes or 1 minute, it's on.
Yes.
And they were the nerve-wracking things about Anzac Day. particularly with the water and all these points, and even is telecom got it patched in right. I mean, you know, we had headphones to check at those days. But I suppose I know the down at the Jubilee Oval. Is there? I think it's a Jubilee Oval, or the University Oval. Is that it?
Yeah, it used to be. It's built on now.
Yes. Well, I remember doing a couple of big congresses down there for the Catholic Church people. They were big jobs. But the biggest jobs of the lot would have been the Royal Tours.
Yes.
We would have up to 200 speakers, loudspeakers. And one that sticks in mind, well, I've got some, I haven't got it with me today, but I'll show you sometime if you're interested. We had a big write-up, pages of it in the Chamber of Manufacturers Journal, it was those days. That was at Wayville, and we had systems, not only the track, but other systems elsewhere. But that was more compact. The biggest one that comes to my mind and area and spread of equipment would have been the one they held at the Victoria Park Racecourse and all the park lands as well, because you see they had 200,000 or more kids. Yes. Came from all the public schools and all the Catholic schools, all the other schools, I suppose, country-wise and everywhere else. You know, they were big jobs those days. And, of course, you had to have an enormous amount of equipment which you'd never won again till the next Royal Tour, because it wasn't the same sort of gear, generally speaking, that you use on the race course.
And the amplifiers that you use for those sort of jobs, were they amplifiers you'd built yourself, or were you buying commercial stuff?
Oh, no, all major own those days.
Yes. And did you ever use commercially built stuff in your time?
Oh, in the latter time. We started making the first solid state jobs ourselves. Oh, got a lot of headaches too. I think everybody did. But we had a lot of problems with those. Just blowing up and so forth. Once again, you learn a lot. But of course, it got to a stage then where it wasn't economic. As a little company, it's the same as the big ones. Who makes it in Australia?
Yes.
Unfortunately,
yes.
Nobody much at all. And but it's all there's Tower, and well, Tower is about the most consistently more recent years, most consistently good quality stuff. But a lot of the stuff we made up, we did dozens and dozens and dozens of schools. Systems, big rack and panel jobs, 19-inch panels, you know. Well, we still used to make up our own radio tuners, and I used to make my own IF transformers in the old days, even make the trimming condensers with two bits of brass with a mica between them.
Yes.
You know, it's crazy, isn't it? It sounds crazy. Because you did it. And you were that deft, apparently, I must have been, to get them done in the time, because I couldn't do it today, wouldn't know what to do about it.
With that school equipment, did you have to have it checked by some authority?
Yes, PMG again.
Yes.
There was no other authority. Mm. And I don't know whether Cliff had to do with it, did you, those days?
Yeah, occasionally. It was mostly Roy Buckerfield.
Roy Buckerfield, that's right. I think it was in Franklin Street.
That's right,
We'd make the radio tuners, amplifiers. I don't know whether on the one chassis, I've forgotten just on some of them, but anyhow, no, the radio tuner, but they lay down very strict specifications, including the only 8-inch roller, 820s or whatever they were, 8-inch anyhow, magnetic, what do you call them?
Permanent.
And the baffles were really, well, they were too good.
They don't
use them today, but they were too expensive. Beautifully done, proper vented enclosures they were. Slope fronts, controls down, proper H-type ladder controls on down near the blackboard so you can get at them. I've always told publicans, don't put any volume controls on the wall. I'll turn them inside out for you, which everybody did.
Could I just ask you a bit about any training that you might have had in radio or electronics, or how did you get to understand? Do you have any formal training?
Never had a lesson in my life. It's a peculiar thing. I don't know, as I said right at the beginning, I think, I don't know where I got the first bit of information. I must have obviously gotten it from somewhere in some magazines or some printed matter or what. because there was no school of mines. There was school of mines, of course. My father went to school of mines as a motor mechanic. I had his drawing kit, right. Or whatever you call it. However, they didn't have anything. They had electrical engineering, but they didn't have anything in this area. Yeah. And I think it's a sort of a thing that you just grew with, and you did it the hard way. And I suppose in the like to develop something probably took weeks instead of hours. I don't know. It's pretty hard to put it together at this stage now. But even, as I say, even the simple things like these Reese carbon mics, they're simple in themselves, but it wasn't my idea. You had to get that idea. Well, yeah, but you'd copied something. Well, who doesn't? You only learn from somebody else.
Like Radio and Hobbies or something like
that. Well, I guess. What, they have Wireless Weekly later on? Yes. They had a couple of older magazines. Radio and Hobbies was one, but I think that was more than getting on a bit.
It might have been
earlier. At the embryo area, I don't know. I can't recall precisely where I got the dope from, so to speak. But that pieces of equipment, the radio tuner, you had to have the IF channel had to be have the necessary bandwidth, otherwise they'd send it back. We had an odd one to send back, just reach, because you'd lose some instantly.
You used to have to flat top them, as I recall.
That's right, flat top. And the distortion factor on the amplifier and the output, of course, they'd be spot on. They'd send them back. So, yeah. We knew how to do them after a bit.
Yes.
We did, because I was in retail the side of the game as well, and we thought that was a good idea to get all these schools, all the kids go to school. Whether that ever did any good, I don't know. They were just a business in thought.
Yeah.
But, today, the old school, I wouldn't get to base one. And I even giving away the high technology today, one wouldn't get to base one.
No, I was just wondering whether you did have any basic electrical back training or anything like that. You've picked it all up from magazines and journals.
I'm not an avid reader.
No.
I must have done some, as the saying goes. But I suppose, when you think about it, I often think about it myself. Really, how can one do all those things, make all those things, wind all these... I'd wind some transformers. I could, there's lots of other things I could tell about. Guitar amplifiers, LSYs and K. Remember the Adelaide College of Music? Yeah. Used to make all these little amplifiers. We put an electric collector get the first Hawaiian guitars they were. And he'd sell on those nice steam. They're a little, only one, 42 or a EF6 was it? Something like that, output tube, only just one tube. And
what
sort
of a microphone would you use in those? Or was it a trim?
Oh, no, they're just a pick up on the. He would get them. Someone in Sydney, I think, was making the guitars, and they had the pickup built into the thing.
Right, so that would be like steel wires and a magnetic field sort of thing.
Yeah, except they were the Hawaiian tone rather than the modern guitar.
One other thing I thought I might like to ask is how you got involved with the IRE as it was then.
Well, I think that came, as I said, this is a way after my first 12 months. I don't think I finished that story. My only time I worked for the boss was a Newton McLaren.
Mm.
I know it's out of sequence, but perhaps I can tell you very quickly what I did there.
Right.
Well, because those days, there were no AC radios at all, before the AC radio. And they had... I was in the battery department. Acid everywhere. Handkerchiefs, everything else. After a while, like a piece of sieve. Or mosquito netting. And they replate. They had a battery department there with hundreds of accumulators with their 2-volt tubes or whatever. And they had those for the A supplies, we used to call it. And they also Hellisons. Now they were made. They used to make B batteries as well, dry cells, even torch cells. And I reckon they downside better than what they got today. But I think they were made to last. They're made in Sweden or somewhere.
That's right.
Am I guessing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they had the distributorship for these, but they also had, in block fashion, they had I think they were 32 volts or something like that, a block of accumulator B battery cells, rechargeable. And I replated thousands of those. They were open top, if I recall, with a lead, just a, the two and a negative positive coming up, and they just had like what looked like a big glob of solder, if you like, yeah. Possibly, in the factory in the first case. I guess that's how we used to redo them.
Were they what they used to call air cells?
No, they were lead acid. Lead acid.
Open
yes.
top.
Open top.
They were open
yeah.
top, I think, yes. And I guess they gave up a bit of acid fumes when they, especially when they were charged up. And anyhow, that I was there for 12 months. I learned a lot there. Probably that's where it gave me the kickoff. Well, then I resigned. After 12 months, it started on my own. At Somerton, Cutler Street, Somerton.
Right.
And well, so that's before the electric radio. And, of course, they had the Amplin speakers, I said before, and the MCO so forth. And I suppose that's where I bought a terrible lot of my bits and pieces. And Lawrence and Hanson were across the road in Lee Street. And I used to buy Phillips Vowels from Mr. Ferguson. He was the manager there. I used to buy hundreds of vowels, of course. Buy hundreds of the darn things. All sorts, you know. And but anyhow, that gave, I think, at Newton McLaren, and even the loudspeakers, you'd get them in with the bobbins for the old, after all, they're glorified, the horn experiential speakers were only really a decent headphone unit now, weren't they? I suppose just about the same thing. And I'd rewind those. It wasn't my job, but they'd see, well, that's where I want to do things.
Yes.
So I'd have a little mandrel, if I remember there now, and he'd rewind. And of course, that is terribly hard stuff to wind. First of all, it's not circular. And secondly, it's, well, I think it's finer than a hair. It's pretty small, it's pretty light. And of course, that was the reason, I suppose, that you get a breakdown in one every now and again. Mm-hmm. But I guess when I think about it now, I must have learned a lot about, well, I wasn't in the wireless set department, as the saying is. I was just on the batteries, but I used to get myself involved with these other things, even in, without being asked to do it, I guess would be the answer to that. And other little things to do with wireless sets, as we used to call them those days. I guess that's where I really caught the real heavy bug, yeah. As the saying is.
And getting back to the IRE.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry, I didn't answer that. Well, that brought me to Newton McLaren again.
Yes.
Because Jack Hale became a member, and he was the managing director, but he wasn't, to my knowledge, he wasn't a technician. Bill Govanlock, I think he's, and that old stuff I was telling you earlier about,
yes.
Before we got on the tape, about the IRE, all those fellas joined, and they seemed to have a drive. They had a membership drive.
Yes.
At Newton McLaren, with the association of Jack Hale, and of course Norman Fisk, I think, of AWA, who the founder, was he not, of AWA in Australia,
Ernest
Fisk.
Yes,
he was the president, I think, nationally wide,
he was,
or Sydney,
yes,
or
he was, yes,
of the RE, and I think this that would be pretty authentic. I would say that Newton McLaren made a drive at that stage. And then in 1936, I have a volume that was put out. Now, what was that represent? It must have been a reason that the IRE put out a great voluminous, beautifully bound thing on the whole organisation. And there's only about Don Gooding's there, Bill Gumler, of course, and Jack Hale, and some other, Stan Ackland, I think, who's Newton McLaren. I've forgotten offhand now, but there's a lot of other names. But there seemed to be only about, roughly speaking, about 20 members, and our names are just listed there. Now, that was printed in 1936. So when you think about it, it's 54 years ago.
So any more or less anybody who was technically involved,
I think,
with radio could...
Yeah, they made me an associate member.
Yes.
Of course, as I said in intermediate times, in recent times too, that if I were to have to sit for an exam, I wouldn't get past the front door. However, it's a matter of what you can do now in performance, I guess. And mine is just, I suppose, just what hard yak and
you're involved,
getting yourself involved in
at the time.
What you're doing, and then of course you got the business as well. So to sum it up, I don't know how the deuce I ever had the time to wind all these things, make all the chassis, do everything yourself, and at the same time we're doing every country show from around the peninsula before Whyalla was developed, Port Augusta, you'd go, and you know, it's like these dirty, dusty days. All rotary converters, by the way, no AC power. No, in fact, we would have as many as five or six or at least picnics in Long Gully in the hills on a one day. And you have to have men, you'd get these blokes from someplace, and fix up some sort of stand, because you'd only have one or two, couple of vehicles at the most.
Yes.
And have stands for the speakers. And probably the old Reese carbon mics in the early first days, with all was battery operated. And of course, this is before the power supply efficiencies that you get today. Invariably, they were the bigger ones were 32 volt. The old company still had them, as far as I know. 32 volt, and you couldn't get more than 50% efficiency. Mm. Well, you wouldn't get that or anything. So really, I could write books about racetracks. Where the battery cells are disappearing one after the other, you know, and you'd even short one out.
Yes.
To keep the system going.
Yes.
Or you'd shut it off in between and you'd wait for it to heat up, which you couldn't do today, of course, because of the brace braking program. But those days, you'd be out on the flat with your vehicle and your equipment, and I take it that we must have used 5CK with Trelaw, one of the, if it's the B-class stations, I can't recall which ones now precisely, but you'd take it off the air. So, of course, you're losing intelligibility with a super heterodyne for a start, that, you know, real sibilance, which is so necessary with PA, and the equipment would be even making it worse because it wouldn't need the speakers from the woe to go. You still had to get to all those eardrums out there and across the tracks.
Yeah, what would you say would be the highlight of your career? What would be the thing that you know that you did most? Well, I guess we should stick to the PA or radio business. The thing that you sort of say, well, you know, that was probably one of the most significant things I did or achieved or.
I suppose that royal tour that I mentioned, particularly the one in Victoria Park, that was a pretty massive kind of a job, really.
That'd be the first royal tour after the war, would it?
Oh,
when the Queen came out here.
Was out to
about
more
40,
than once.
35 years ago or something like that.
All that. I suppose I could dig out the dates on those functions. But, we had speakers. Oh, we had miles of wiring, of course. Mm. Flex, figure eight flex. That's all we used. And of course, since in the Grand Prix, well, I only lined that up. I had nothing to do with it after that. Mm. But that's a different story. There's one advantage with that. There was no great ambient noise to overcome, I guess, with a royal tour of that sort. Streetwise, yes. We didn't do too much of that in the streets. They were talking about putting in a permanent thing once, but they never did. They've got it in Melbourne, which they ought to have here, by the way, for other functions. But getting back to it out there, you see, they had these thousands, I think about 200,000 children, I think, by memory. And they had these all graded and assembled in groups, all in those olive trees and all the parkland surrounding, not on the so much on the race course proper as around. Those other areas there, they were like East Park lands, you'd call them, wouldn't you?
That's right.
So that they all had to be serviced, and I guess they were separate, just public address systems to get control of the kids.
Different areas. And what about your most, say, hair-raising experience in public address?
Oh,
most people in PA have got some of those.
Oh,
I suppose it would be an Anzac Day.
Oh, well, I wouldn't be here, but my age now, one half hour, I'd be at the nearest mortuary. No, I mentioned earlier about the one getting wet and
yes.
so forth. Well, I had to run myself.
Yes.
I had to run up to the next point, which is it's a long way from that down there up to Government House.
Yes.
But you see, the march is nearly finished.
Yes.
And they had, what, 3 or 4 or 5 times as many marching those days as we've got today in the Long March. Well, I had to rush up the hill and up in an office somewhere in King William Street. Apparently they must have gone past that. Now you can imagine the predicament.
Yeah.
Didn't have a spare. And it was a chassis only, and boy was it heavy, because the power transformers themselves and the output transformers. I think those, if I remember rightly, they were not mine, they were made by Trimax.
Yes.
Remember Trimax transformers?
Yeah.
And the little new metal Trimax, there, no doubt about those transformers there, even to this day, they might be 40, 50 years old. I've never had one fail or seen one or heard of a failure. However, some of their power transformers, I could beat them on that because they weren't reliable enough. It's mostly, I'm getting away from the nerve again, it's to do with the lack of beautifully made, terrific transformers really in every other way except probably girls on the mandrels winding and done by hand those days otherwise, and it's where the terminations come and go. Mm-hmm. And just quickly bring me back, but I want to mention one thing I used to do on the big transformers. It's all a matter of using common. Now, this is just, it's just my own ideas, or other people have probably done it. And that is, you'd wind the primary. Oh, and by the way, at the Adelaide Oval, bring me back to it, will you? At the Adelaide Oval, the regulation of the AC power supply, which was before the Trust took over, way back in the dim ages, it got down to 160 volts when the pie warmers and all the things were on. Now, you had to take care of that, otherwise you wouldn't get any steam.
Yes.
So the transformers I would wind and the amplifiers, and even the first one I put in there permanently, I had, I think, 200, 220, 240. But I used to have tappings down with a switching, only a wave change switch with gaps between, of course, naturally,
yes.
On the panel, because you never know when you have to use it.
Yes.
That was the terrible regulation. The wires must have heated up running into the place. Now, I've gone off my track now.
This was a good place to turn over the original cassette and also this reel tape.
Oh, I think we got to the stage where we were talking about the size of core. They'd have a window, and I might add that I had a gentleman, I can't remember his name and I should, he was a terrific engineer, a backyarder, but he had a nice workshop. He used to make all his own dies. He'd make all the little door switches and a lot of other gear for General Motors, for Holdens, for the thousands. And I had him, and I had a terrible job to get him to do them because he was stuck for time. He was a clever bloke, a clever engineer. Down in behind Cheltenham, sort of down that part of the world. And these laminations were quite hefty things, a two-inch tongue, as I'd call it, top-class Stalloy, not that thick, mucky stuff they have in some of the cheap transformers, and everything, you know, where the butts were, you'd just bend it and pop it through, nothing is just slamming bits together, they're all one with the twin window and one sheet. Beautifully done, and no drag. Stalloy, you know what it's like. It's terribly hard stuff. Gee, it's hard to cut. But his dies were that perfect that there was never any tongues or drags of the metal, sharp as a razor. And I'd get a stack of those to do whatever number of transformers I want. The best, the big stuff, the bigger blokes. And I've forgotten what wattage they'd be now, but they'd handle quite a bit of power.
Were you looking? 200 watts or so.
Oh, probably a lot bigger than that. Anyhow, the 4x4. Now, I'd use a piece of fibre, the old red sheet fibre, and make that up, just a block of wood, of course, with a great bolt through it, and then go into the chuck of the old drill first.
Yes.
And then I got a better drill. Never used a power, never did I get to a stage where I had a power-driven mandrel. crazy. And on air and made one mistake once. I didn't put the centre tap where it should have been. So say a 1,000 volts aside, one was 900 and the other one was 1,100 when I went to put it on test after pickling it as best I could, because I didn't have any evacuation means or anything, but I used to pickle them in resin, beeswax, depending on what transformer, whether it's high voltage or not, I'd use different mix, you know. Then he burnt a place down once too and caught fire. But still on the transformers?
Yes.
Well, this one advantage, particularly when I had these others break down, that I said, well, there's got to be a better way to kill a cat, the saying goes. I thought to myself, gun it out. So what I did then, I had the, you wound the primary with all these tappings that I talked about. Then you put your static shield, brass, right across, and made sure that you got thorough installation. Empire cloth, we used to call it. Yes. Empire paper, and then it was a super stuff we used to use for the high voltage stuff. Well, there were two advantages by using then what I, in the latter years, the big transformers, the high voltage things. They're about 1300 a side, and mercury vapor 806 tubes, you know, rectifiers. And just a swinging choke. I'd make the swinging chokes as well.
866s.
866s.
That's right.
I must tell you a funny one in a minute. Not funny, it was nearly a disaster. In fact, it blew the transformer up in due course by the stupidity of one of my operators, or two of them, at the guardhouse at Government House, would you believe it? Now, bring me back to that if you don't mind. But just to finish off this, I got up to work at the static shield, your neutral for the high tension is the nearest to the static shield. Yes. So you wind one bobbin halfway, took it around the other way, and wound the other one. So you've got both your high voltages, each other cycle, out on the outer.
Yes.
So not much fear of a breakdown. But boy, you make sure it's away from the window, and there's obviously sheets of mica in there. You know, make sure about it, because they're custom made. Well, you wouldn't get this with the factory produced job, you see. So the only one I ever had fail was getting back to this happened to be the operating point, and this is more latter years, apart from what we talked about before with Anzac Day. This is the guardhouse, and I had one of these little big amplifiers down there with a couple of 805s, which goes a lot. They only go about 300 watts. Power, but it's the sort of power, as I said before, triads that we could, you know, you could really drive them. I drive those with a couple of 6 A3s, 2 A3s first, they're the 2.5 volt on there, 6 A3s later. Yeah. So you'd power drive those very hard. These are kinks that I knew about, and it seemed at that stage there, nobody else seemed to catch on to. And I remember buying a transformer in one day. It might have been a Trimax, I can't remember now. But the trick here, this is another trick of the trade I found. The impedance, and particularly the DC resistance of the secondary of that driving transformer into those Class B tubes, whether they're 50s, old 50s, or whether they're 805s or whatever, has got to be extremely low.
Yes.
Tie the grids down.
Yes.
Now that's where I beat everybody else, the old days.
Yeah.
And they couldn't understand, as I said before, why I kept using triads when on paper these tetrodes and did marvellous things. So on this particular day, I was just doing a check around. So I walked up from down yonder at the Pennington Gardens up to the guardhouse, which is my usual thing. This is 20 years ago now, I suppose, but anyhow, there's the port, the meter. I always had a current meter, which acted as a, with Class A or about B, it of course acts as a darn good level meter as well. Least number of complications, the better.
Yes.
Less to go wrong. That was another one of my theories, always. Simple as possible. So as soon as I looked at it, this meter and the tubes, the old 806s, they're working in reverse. Well, it's in permanent spuric oscillation. And this bloke's there, they understand they're doing nothing about it. And the transformer got to the stage where, well, afterwards, and it, probably that day, it just saw the march out. It cooked it.
Gee.
Just the heat.
Mm.
It's sucking this tremendous current for whatever time it was on. God knows, it might have been half an hour, I don't know now, I can't recall the precise time. Do you know why it was that? We had a Trimex transformer line to grid sort of thing. And I had to wind on the old ones myself, the early days, but you had to put those in little aluminium box with a bit of shielded wire, non-covered, of course, to get away from the induction, magnetic interference. These were then these multi-shielder things at this time. Just with a couple of turns and the PMG or telecom line onto it. And they had a potentiometer on it. Well, all he needed to have done, which I did in a flash, one flash, is turn the gas up there and turn it down the PA.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're running into oscillation.
Yeah.
As simple as that. And they do nothing about it.
Yeah.
And you see, this is the problem when you haven't got experienced guys on the practical side.
Yeah. Well, you've had some difficulty getting guys to work, like weekend after weekend, because a lot of those workers
it was always a drag.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, because the good blokes, you tried to get them to work all the time, and practically all of our work was after hours.
Yes.
And, of course, the holidays, I don't know how many hours a week I worked, I wouldn't never know, I would hate to think. I've often said some of the... Yeah. Out there, like some of the young ones don't know what a hard day's work is.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've all said that about various.
But what about staff? That was another thing I was going to ask you. How many staff would you have had at Nomis at its peak?
We probably had about six blokes on the bench.
Yes.
Alone. Six or seven. A lot of repairs. We used to repair hundreds of radio sets.
Yeah.
The old valve days.
Yeah, plus some other guys that used to do the outside, like the PA work, the installations.
And installation work. Oh, you mostly had your own, because those odd special days, Anzac Day now, for instance,
yes.
I'd probably have to import or hire a couple of other fellows.
Yes.
And they mightn't even be technicians, as long as you had someone to sort of try and supervise. And that's what happened that particular day, that I happened to catch this in the act. Otherwise, it wouldn't have seen out the Anzac Day march. It was in the early parts of the march, but relatively so. Mm.
And what about coming back to things like the school jobs and the showgrounds and that sort of thing? Did you have electricians to do your wiring, or did your own people do the wiring?
No, we did our own.
Like the permanent wiring. I'm thinking of the places that were permanently installed, not just the ones
did our own.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, there may have been certain odd occasions you'd get in a contractor, but in general, we would do our own.
Yeah.
Of course, we did a lot of the big first supermarkets and all John Martin, because I Kangaroos on Parade, for instance. Ron Solomon, poor old Ron just passed away in recent times, and Jack Burgess and all those fellas. And see, nobody much in the very early days, Carriage by Canal, I did all the first ones, because nobody else knew anything about PA those days at all.
Did you have much opposition during your time in the PA
business? Oh, Lord, yes. As I said to my wife originally, if I'd charged, had a brain, what's left of mine now, on today's values, I should have been a millionaire, because I could have monopolised.
Yes.
But you see, then Bland's came into it.
Yes.
Because they made all their own metalwork and everything else, and transformers.
Yes.
And they are, and the more latter, I gave the schools away finally. They just went a proposition. I said, okay, you can have them.
Yeah.
But Phillips were the other people. Now the irony of that thing is that Phillips don't even have anything to do with public address in Australia whatsoever. Now, nothing. They had an occasion to find out, because I wanted something recent time. So really, it's an entire change scene altogether. There was another point, I've forgotten it now.
Anyway, perhaps that fair bit of material there. I don't know if there's any other things that Cliff might have thought of that he might like to ask. Anything that you've thought of?
I was wondering if you wanted to mention your early competitor in public address work. I've forgotten the name now. Sound something or other?
Oh, Sound Ray?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, well, actually, that was an interesting thing. As a matter of fact, he's the man that had that speaker, the old M20 that I spoke of earlier. Mm. His name, and I can mention his name, I suppose he's dead and buried now and here. His name was Phyllis, and he was a little Jewish kind of a looking fellow, and they called him Cupy. Can I mention things that he shouldn't have done? Okay. Well, during the war, he probably made a fortune. He bootlegged everything. Tires, whiskey, you name it. And he, you see, being a completely opposite type of fellow, not like the gentleman they just caught, that's what he was a pretty smart fellow. But he knew nothing about it himself. And he had a fellow called Ben. I mentioned his name earlier, but I'm forgetting his other name now. I only met the man once. But I went up to Tamworth on one occasion. Well, perhaps I'm jumping ahead. I'll tell you quickly as possible what happened. He was the man with this M20. And he got into the show society. In fact, he was doing the races too, first. But of course, he was a real... a mixer, you know what I mean, a shrewd, well, almost conniving kind of a fellow, but anything he did outside the law, he knew someone who knew somebody. Yeah. He was a real character of his own. He was a real identity, a put real it that go-getter. Way. Oh, go-getter would be putting in mildly. But he was a shrewd fellow, I've struck other people in other industries and areas myself since. And whilst the Aussies working out like me how to make a buck or a shilling those days, he's got all these other things he's thinking all the time, how to get to the next base. But I'm too busy doing what I've got to do. In retrospect, that's one of the defects I had. However, you can't have everything, they tell me. But anyhow, I remember a fella called Mr. Hazeldine. Now, he was the secretary of the Adelaide Racing Club. See, they were all different clubs, remember, until recent times, more recent times. There was Port Adelaide Jockey Club, and of course I took them all over later on, but anyhow, he had this fellow, Ben, and I take it that he was a bloke a little bit like myself in the technical side. He had one of these bigger amplifiers too, like the 50-watt big jumbo sockets. Yeah. And he used a direct couple system. And I tried one once, and I reckon it was too dicky, as the saying is. In other words, up to his driving stage, he used a what's the transformer? What do you call a transformer without a primary secondary?
Auto transformer.
Yeah. He had his auto transformer, and he only had one driving tube, so he had a sort of not a completely balanced driving system. And of course, he had they were biased. I think about 50, 60 volts bias.
Yes.
But on top of that, you've got this amplifier up to from the input to the driver with one power supply. And on top of that, you've got this, you're sitting there, the one stacking it on top of it, with he might have had about 1,000 volts on the anodes of these output tubes, plus the bias. And, but you never see anything about a chassis, generally, no covers, real crude. But the thing is, it worked, you see. And that's how he got into doing some of the things, and he's a racing fiend, and it's a matter of getting into the right people, put it that way. And I'm a little insignificant bloke, I'm not mixing with that sort of fraternity. In fact, I've been to thousands and thousands of race meetings, I've often said this, and I couldn't name you one horse now In fact, I used to get in some embarrassing positions. People would come and ask me, what run the last? And there I am standing there. We got up to the race tracks. We're talking about Victoria Park. Well, this fellow, I got involved with him pretty deeply, so much so that my father was still with me then helping out, and he used to do the announcement. In fact, I've got a picture here of the Snowdown Trots, and there he is with a white coat on,
yeah.
And he did the ordinary announcing. So he'd help me out. Mm-hmm. He became involved with me in that way. And he was the log chopper announcer at the Adelaide show every year,
yeah.
Before the professionals came into the scene, all this. And let's think now. We're on the races. No, but before we get to the races, really, this fellow Ben, the ad, see, Coopy knew nothing about it, nothing into it. He wouldn't know how to turn it on. That's a true statement. He relied on this fellow. Now, he was doing Victoria Park, and it doesn't matter, I won't go into the details now, so much to just concentrate on Victoria Park as the relevant one, not this part of the story. This fellow Ben, he was going down to the southeast somewhere, and Coopy was driving, and they had an accident with a bridge or a car or something, and this poor fellow got killed. And of course, Coopy is left like a shag on a rock. And I was operating, this must be 40 years ago now, because I was operating from my parents' home oh my God, it must be more than I've been married 51 odd years, my God. T-I-M-E. We're on Anzac Highway. And that's where we shifted the workshop I had, same one almost, up to the back of Anzac, 160 Anzac Highway, Glandor, I remember the address. Now, that's about the time I knew. It'd be getting on to 45 years ago at least, probably longer. And anyhow, this fellow... he was left lamenting, of course, no nothing. No technician, no operator, knew nothing about it. So he must have got hold of... Oh, I know what he did. I can mention names here. This man's dead too now. Do you remember... he's probably still around. The Farmers Radio? They called it... was it something? No, other like was X. It was a Sound Ray, which is a good name. Farmer, no, I think he called it Farmers something. He had a name too, remember,
Max
Cliff?
Max Farmer? Yeah.
But he called his PA. Max didn't like PA. But John Cleary, who was his partner, was not a technical man. But he was a sort of a doer. In fact, he killed himself at a processional kind of a function one time, his sister told me, when someone he sat up on the Saturday and they pinched his speakers, some of them. And he got very, he had a heart problem. Anyhow, that's another story. The poor fellow's not with us anymore. But they had some not bad name, I thought. No, he took over Sound Ray or something, what was left of it, finally, I think. He got involved with him. It's a bit of a long story. I'm going to try and shorten as much as possible. This fellow, Coopy, lived in a flat with a certain lady, these were the naughty days, I don't think. I can name her, but I won't. She came from Broken Hill. And those things weren't done those days, but all Coopy did. And they lived in High Street, Dunelg, had a flat there sort of thing. And we were still at Somerton. Yes, we're still at Somerton. And this must have been about the transition time up to Anzac Highway. So it's a long time ago. And this fellow was killed, so Coopy was left lamenting, as I said. And then Coopy came to me at Somerton. I was still operating down at Somerton, that's right, because they hadn't yet shifted up to Glandor. And I lived up in another area, personally. And he came to me and wanted to know whether I'd help him out.
Yeah.
So, Muggins Simon, I agreed that my father would be with me to help out, like he had been, and I would get one third of the takings. And I can see this meeting now right in High Street in his place. And I had one of his amplifiers all in pieces because I was going to redesign it. And of course I had my own amplifiers as well. So it was a pretty good setup from his point of view. He had a backup. And I suggested to my father that I'd woken up to the fact that I'm doing all the work, tearing around to every country race meeting, trots meeting, things that I'm not interested in here, all converters. And one stage we had an alternator on a Chev van. Could you imagine? And let me come back to it. These are interesting pieces of history. And a flexible hose you'd put on the exhaust box because you're still out on the flat operating at all these places. And you'd run this darn thing with the hose. Forgot to take the hose one day, up Snowdown or somewhere. Well, I nearly asphyxiated. I nearly killed me. Oh, I was crooked that night. That's by the way.
You had to keep the motor running.
You had to keep shutting it off because you see, even the car would boil.
Mm.
You see, you're not doing sufficient revs and dragging air through the fans through the system. Oh, we didn't stick on that too long. Great massive blimping alternator. Just change the fan belt.
Mm.
Right. Well, I'm working my insides out. All these, as I said before, nobody else except this bloke coming into the scene knew anything about it, getting on a bit now further than the earlier story. So I had a discussion with my father about it. I said, well, look, it's words to the effect that it's ridiculous. We're doing all the work, the two of us. There's two of us. We're doing all the work, and we're getting the wrong end of the stick.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the figures. I wouldn't have a clue. Whether it was lucrative or not, I don't remember. So I made a meeting with him, and I said I had one of his amplifiers and bits. We went up to his place that night, and although I was on a youngish man, probably 23 or 4 or something, 5 perhaps, at least I started to see a bit of light in this area, and I said, right, I want a 50-50 solid arrangement or I'm out. And he wouldn't play. Well, that's peculiar because the next morning they must have been right at the point of transition to my parents shifting to Anzac Highway, because he came up to there. He said, okay, I'll settle for 50-50. Well, that morning I'd been into 5AD to see Don Gooding as the chief engineer. This is the Carols by Candlelight, very much in the early days. And Coopy had a sidekicker who, well, I don't know what you call him. He wasn't a technical man. You knew nothing about it. He was the minder, I think you'd call him. Oh, he's no boy then, that minder chappy. Anyhow, that's by the way. And he was coming. He came into 5AD, but I beat him to the counter, if you know what I mean. Because this, to book up for the Candles by Candlelight, you see. Well, of course, Don knew Don, so he wouldn't have done it before, probably. I've forgotten now what year it was. So, of course, he was turned away, and we did it for many years. So that was that. And then he went to John Clary, or Farmers. He took them over. They got involved with him. Mm-hmm. And that's where Farmers X Sound Ray, so he took over the Sound Ray part of it. Well, really, he used up me, and then I decided I wasn't going to be used up any longer. And when he came back, I said, not on, QB. No. I said, I've gone on my own. I said, that made the decision. And I always remember my father's story. I said, I think you acted too hastily. No, I said, I made the decision. So that's that.
Yeah.
And that's how I got, that was the end of that. And then, of course, John Clary was doing it, and I don't know whether he was connected with the out of Victoria Park, but I knew that things were going extremely bad. Now, this might have happened before John Clary got involved out of Victoria Park, and I might have been business one day to go out on the flat, and I could tell that they were in diabolical trouble. And previous to that, I'd written to Hazelton, the secretary, and offered our services. And no, I never got any reply. So I knew they were going bad to me. What he tried to do, of course, to do, he got big troubles with sound delay by not having sufficient power to drive from the flat. Well, we use these railway lines, by the way. Yeah. We put new ones up. Oh, they're 20 feet high with permanent halfway down steel ladders. Oh, hard work. And these big M20s you'd take up there. And you know, they were heavy, 56 pounds each, I think they weighed. And I knew they were getting into diabolical trouble. This is not relevant, is it, this talk? This part?
Well, I don't know.
We have to
probably finish it off fairly soon because time's marching on.
Righto. Well, the thing is, I better try and finish it now off. Hazeldine, then, they got to a stage where obviously they're having big problems. So they rang. The next thing, I got a call from Mr. Hazeldine on the phone. Mr. Simon, would you be prepared to do the races out of Victoria Park? And I always remember, probably a bit sarcastically, I would imagine, you know, Mr. Hazeldine, I've written to you. You haven't had the courtesy to reply. Of course I am prepared to do it. Well, of course, that was the end of that particular show altogether. And but there are other things later on, which I can tell you about afterwards, but in the same track, as a matter of fact. Anyhow, I've heard you've got plenty of paraphernalia there to go on.
Probably we've got enough information there if we can edit it.
Yeah, that's going to be a difficult thing because I've done so much jumping. And that's where Farmers X sound race. He took over the sound ray part of it. Well, really, he used up me, and then I decided I wasn't going to be used up any longer. And when he came back, I said, "Not on, QB." No, I said, "I've gone on my own." I said, "That made the decision." And I always remember my father. He said, "I think you acted too hastily." No, I said, "I made the decision." So that's that. And that was the end of that. And then, of course, John Cleary was doing it. And I don't know whether he was connected with the outer Victoria Park, but I knew that things were going extremely bad. Now, this might have happened before John Cleary got involved, out of Victoria Park. And I might have a business one day to go out on the flat, and I could tell that they were in diabolical trouble. And previous to that, I'd written to Hazeldine, the secretary, and offered our services. And no, I never got any reply. So I knew they were going bad to me. What he tried to do, of course, he got big troubles with sound delay by not having sufficient power to drive from the flat. Well, we use these railway lines, by the way. Yeah. We put new ones up. Oh, they're 20 feet high with permanent halfway down steel ladders. Oh, hard work. And these big M20s you'd take up there and, you know, they were heavy, 56 pounds each, I think they weighed. And I knew they were getting into diabolical trouble. This is not relevant, is it, this talk? This part?
Well, I don't know.
We have to probably
finish it off fairly soon because time's marching on.
Righto. Well, the thing is, I better try and finish it now off. Hazeldine, then, they got to a stage where obviously they're having big problems. So they rang, the next thing, I got a call from Mr. Hazeldine on the phone. Mr. Simon, would you be prepared to do...